welcome, everybody. This is Vin Free. This is Monday, January 17th, and this is our Internet live broadcast on EBS Radio. And we do this every week. We have different formats depending on different factors, and except on third Monday, we have a standard format, and we have Carla Ruckert on as our guest with Terry Brown, who's no longer a guest. She's a host. So, Carla, are you there?
I am there. Hello, Wynn. How are you?
Fine, thank you. And Terry, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Well, you know what? I picked a topic, and I didn't want it by Carla. So she may say, I don't want to do that. Uh-oh. Somebody dinging in on our conference call. But when you're muted, we can't hear you. Let me just mute those phones.
Entry and exit times are off.
And did you have a nice holiday, Carla?
I had a couple of splendid holidays. Very quiet and intimate and family and very pleasant. And then for New Year's Eve, we talked on the air. we did a question and answer show for L&L Research. So it was not
right.
A party night for me. It was shared with my people.
were you channeling or answering from your conscious mind?
No. I was answering questions. But we do this every week, and Monica and I talked about it. She's the one who is the moderator for that and also for our forum on Bring Forth. And she said, well, you know, I really need Christmas Eve, she said, but I'm not doing anything for New Year's. What about you? And I said, well, we try to stay off the streets. And she said, well, let's do a show then. So that's what I did for New Year's Eve. I just hung out with my seekers.
When I was in high school, I had one of my few car accidents on New Year's Eve when some drunk driver came on head-on and clipped me. So
Lord.
I've tried not to go out on New Year's Eve since that time. Now, you had something...
Yeah.
did you have something special happen on Saturday?
Saturday. It was special, Wynn. It surprised both Jim and me, but a whole bunch of people from all over the globe wrote in thank you notes on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of the first Ra session. And it was just the most moving thing. I haven't finished reading them all yet, but it's just lifts you up so much to know that you've made a difference. You know, everybody hopes in their life that they get a chance to serve, a chance to make a difference. And I've got a basic scrapbook of people that wrote in and said, you made a difference, and thanks a bunch. So I am in alt. I'm just...
Yeah, I was in there.
I haven't gotten to you yet. Thanks a lot. But it was so
impressive. You
know what?
We wouldn't be doing this show right now if it wasn't for you.
Well, it just has been a wake-up call for a whole lot of people, and I just feel so privileged and so humble that I was able to serve, and hopefully I still am serving. You know, somebody in their thank you note said it so well, a guy named Jeremy. He said, you know, it's not just that Jim and Carla were part of the group that channeled the Law of One contact. It's that they're still kicking and they're still trying to serve. And that's living the Law of One. So that's the other part of it, and that's the part that I hope goes on for a long, long time.
I got a feeling even when you leave this realm, you're going to still be kicking.
I hope I'll be saying, hallelujah, hallelujah.
I would be expecting all those people to get kicks in their heads and saying, oh, there's Carla. She's back with the Rod group, but she's giving us a little kick. You know, I didn't tell Terry, or I'm sure she would have put something in there. I just quickly got it out. So for those of you that are listening and are not aware of who Carla is, And I don't even know if that's the right way, because who is anybody?
It's another thing on the channel.
I'll tell you who she was. Who she is whatever she does tonight. But who she was, 30 years ago, she was in a little channeling class or channeling group, experimental channeling group. And the guy that was the head of the group, who I believe was also a teacher of hers in a college there. Is that correct? Am I getting that right?
He wasn't my teacher, but he was a professor. He was a professor of physics and mechanical engineering, and I wasn't a student of either. Mm. But I went to his experimental ET channeling group from 1962 onward.
So, in 1962. So, you know,
yes,
Carla had been experimenting with channeling from 1962. And in 1981, he asked a very sophisticated question. And the voice that came through Carla said, "I am Ra. You have I'm paraphrasing this, but I am Ra. You have called on us. You need us to answer the sophisticated question. And we are a social memory complex." And Carla went unconscious. She didn't remember anything she said. This was a whole new experience. And for the next, I think, 3 years, they did a whole series of questions to this voice that identified itself as Ra. And they actually explained, the way I explain it, the way they explained themselves, is they said they were a social memory complex, or in simple language, a group soul, and that they were composed of graduates of this realm, beings that went through a period of evolution here, got off the wheel of reincarnation, continued a period of evolution in other realms, and eventually teamed up to be billions or millions, how many? Billions or billions? I never know.
Of what?
Of how many individual souls comprise the broad group?
I don't believe they ever gave a quantity to it, but when you think of how many people are on a planet, I suppose it would be billions.
Billions, okay. So the Ra group is a huge conglomerate. They have sub-councils. They have all kinds of organizations, but they don't have bodies. They're all operating in energy, and except for the ones that have decided to come back into this realm to help, that have bodies. And probably many of you who are listening might be in that category, because there's millions of lost souls in this realm, so they say, that have bodies, and that one of the criteria, one of the circumstances of coming into this realm from a higher dimension is that once you're here, you don't remember that. And according to her channeling, I believe the figure is 90% get caught back up into reincarnation episodes, and 10% find their way to be of service. It's very hard when you come in from a higher realm, obviously, to be of service down here, to know what to do and how to do it. And I know that Carla's material and her raw material has woken up probably tens of thousands of people on this planet to say, yes, that's it. I am one of those people that came in from a higher realm to be here. I don't fit unless I'm of service. And some of you listening are saying that to yourself and think that's it. It makes sense to you. And that's a very big realization, I would say, because now you understand why you don't fit in. Prior to that, you probably thought you were crazy, alienated. What am I doing here? how come I'm different from all these other people? And, you know, he may have even gotten married and tried to be normal and found out, what am I doing in this marriage? How do I work this? I don't fit. It's just boring. And those kinds of people that have those kinds of feelings could very well be raw souls. And usually, if you're a raw soul, not where you only have those kinds of feelings, but you will have deep, intuitive looks at people around you. I remember, I'm sure I'm a raw soul, just for the record, I'm sure I am. And I remember when I was a kid, and I looked at people, and I just understood them all, and I said, when I grow up, I'm going to meet people that really understand, because I couldn't engage them at the level that I was understanding them. You have that experience. You look at people and you can see deeply into them, but they won't reveal that part of themselves, or it's not polite or whatever. So Carla did a very heroic thing, bringing in all that information. And the heroic part was, there are negative beings in other realms that do not want this information available to this realm. It actually has the power, if it was like full blast out, to liberate a lot of this realm. And when Carla started channeling this raw group, she was attacked. And she came close to dying. She was disabled. And she kept doing it. And she knew, she had some inkling of the amount of service that was involved in bringing this in, and she didn't back down. And after a while, probably complicated, but, you know, actually, Rod was stopped coming in after her partner left this realm. And she started channeling the Quo group, which didn't leave her open to such attacks. And, of course, as I've gone through this experience of interdimensional communication, I experienced attacks mostly through Daphne, who would get really attacked when she would be with me, when she would channel. And I started to integrate this idea that there were things in other realms that didn't want this to happen. And that those of you who are listening, you know, this is not like other things. And you've got to, like, reach back towards it, explore it, and study it. And for some of you, if you do that, you will change your life path, and you will change your future incarnation. I'm sure of that. But you have to reach back. It doesn't happen just by itself. So, Carla, did I say everything okay?
Oh, it was great. Yeah. Thank you very much for that. I think about those days. It was a golden period in my life. Of course, as you said, I was under a psychic greeting all the time. And there are just so many stories, but it was just an adventure, I guess you'd say, and I realized as I lost weight, I kept losing weight until I was having trouble keeping 80 pounds on my body, and Don kept begging me, just try to get up to 85. Fortunately, I have very small bones, and I was never in any problem. It didn't cause me a health problem to lose all that weight, but it was obvious that something was burning away a lot of my physical, and in that state, I was more open to infections. A sore throat became bronchitis, became a staph infection, and at one point in the sessions, Don was asked by Ra if he would ask me to cough before I spoke, you know. So Don would ask a question, and they'd say, and please cough before you answer, because the Ra group had to get it together to get this body that they were working with to cough. And there would be this pause and then a cough, and then we planned to start selling the downloads of the actual sessions as soon as we can go through all of the rigmarole that you have to do to start offering them. There's a lot of stuff that goes into it, and they want Jim and me to tell people what our memories were of each session. After the people listed the session, then they'll get Jim and me just talking about it.
They're going to have to edit all the costs, right?
Yeah, well, I don't think so. I think they're going to leave them on there because the whole idea is, what was it really like? And it was kind of funny what it was really like when the coughing was there. But at any rate, it was an adventure indeed, and it was quite clear early on that what the greeters wanted was for me to leave the incarnation. But they didn't make that. I really, really, really wanted to do this service. And then, too, I adored Don Elkins, who was the questioner in the contest. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful man, probably the single most intelligent, wise man I have ever met in my life. And I knew him well. It's not something that I'm saying because he impressed me. But I lived with him for 16 years, so I know him well. And you can't say too many good things about Don Elkins. And I wanted to do this for him because he was a melancholy man. Remember that song by the Moody Blues? I'm a melancholy man doing what I can. Anyway, he was like that. But he was happy when he was talking to those of Ra. So I wanted to see that look on his face one more time. So I always wanted to do the next session regardless of how if I was fainting or if I was keeling over, whatever was happening in the drama of the body, you know, I just really, really wanted to do that next session. So it was a golden time for the three of us, Jim McCarty, Don Elkins, and me, and I pulled up the first session, and just to give you an idea of what it's like to listen to Ra, nobody had asked a question yet. He was just saying who he was. So he says, let us for a moment consider thought. What is it, my friends, to take thought? Took you then thought today? What thoughts did you think today? What thoughts were part of the original thought today? And how many of your thoughts did the creation abide? Was love contained, and was service freely given? You are not part of a material universe. You are part of a thought. You are dancing in a ballroom in which there is no material. You are dancing thoughts. You move your body, your mind, and your spirit in somewhat eccentric patterns, for you have not yet completely grasped the concept that you are part of the original thought. That little paragraph there kind of gives you an idea of what Ra was like. And the original thought, according to Ra, was love, the Logos. Remember how John, the book Gospel of John, starts in the Bible. In the beginning was the Word.
Mm-hmm.
The Word was with God, and the Word was God, and so forth. And the word for word in Greek is Logos, and one of the definitions of the one great original thought that Ra offered was Logos. So it's, as far as Ra is concerned, it's a universe of love. And so, you know, he's asking us on the level of our thoughts, what are you thinking? Are you thinking loving thoughts? Is love part of that thought? If not, where is the love and why don't you go there, basically, is what the idea, the inference is. And I think that it's just basic good advice. If you can move your mind to ponder thoughts of love, if you can think of love when you're looking at the person to whom you're talking, if you can keep love in mind when there is no love in the situation and everybody's wrangling, then you bring love to the situation and you see what you can do with that. Sometimes you can't do a thing. Sometimes you just have to sit there in love and let it all happen around you. Sometimes you can make a really big difference. So I am so grateful.
Oftentimes, I find that there's a situation that if I go into it and I say certain things, the whole situation turns around. The problem is, when I say those things, it's going to catalyze the situation. So the situation might not turn around, and everyone will get mad at me. Usually that never happens. But I know there's an act of volition that I have to take. And I have to be willing to risk where the situation has settled. Like, maybe I'll just tell a bunch, let's suppose, I don't know if I've ever done this in particular, but, you know, sometimes people get together, and there's like a social interaction, and there's people that are bitching, and they're negative, and they're complaining, and they're talking about other people. And you're in that situation, and you can feel the energy of it. And then walking in and say, listen, guys, if you're going to continue talking like this, I don't want to be here. So, you know, if you want me to be here, we got to change the nature of the conversation or I'm out the door. And you see, that really confronts people. They might say, see you later, Lynn. But you know what? I mean it. It puts it on the table so that it forces the issue. And every time I've ever forced, almost every time I've forced an issue, almost, the issue, the situation has changed. The people became more present. There was more loving interaction. We started to talk about the things that was they were doing or that I was doing, rather than doing them. And you know, when you're in a circumstance like this, there's no judgment when people are doing that because it is so habitual, it is so normal that you can't blame them for doing it. If you blame them, you're not going to be able to put love into it. You've got to, like, open your mouth and provoke the circumstance to either move or walk out the door. You'd be amazed. You would be amazed how that works. And you also notice how hard it is to do it because, like, oh, God, if I do that, this is my daughter-in-law. She's going to be mad at me. I can't say that to my daughter-in-law. You know? And you'll say, you don't want to rock the boat. So you'd rather stay in the situation as it is, where everyone just badmouths everyone, than to upset it. So you have to have an act of a little bit of courage to be willing to upset it and risk it. I hope I don't get in trouble now and have all these emails coming in from people saying, we did it win and it didn't work and now they will never talk to us again. But in any case, now, that's not Terry's style. Terry, how do you bring love to a situation?
I just carry it. It's like at the highest frequencies, it's just really pure. And so if everything falls apart, I just go there and spread it all the, you know, just by drawing down a drape or like putting it over it or like sending it and waiting till things cool down.
You know, the amazing thing about Terry is I've watched her, and there could be a bunch of people doing the kind of conversation that I just described, that where they're just talking about people and complaining about people, and Terry would probably never do what I just suggested. And somehow, she sits in that situation, and I've watched the situation just kind of like flow out of where it was to a new place, because Terry has the ability to, how can I say it? I've been using this analogy of water and rock, where water wins, where when you come up against a rock, if you just gently flow around it, you get on the other side, as opposed to bumping your nose up into it and confronting it. So Terry seems to be able to, like, put all these fuzzy little angelic things around the rocks, and they just go, woof.
Well, it's not really fuzzy, Wynn. She's holding the truth. She's holding the light.
Well, when I say fuzzy,
it's like a lighthouse for everybody. And they drawn to that light, you know?
Right. So everyone has to a different style. But the question for everyone is, how do you move the situation from where it is to love? Okay? How do you do that? And if you keep asking that question, something inside you will give you an answer. And suddenly, it'll work. You'll transform all those difficult situations into loving circumstances. Or you'll leave them. There's no reason to hang out in the circumstance that's not loving if you can. And I won't say there's no reason. There could be a reason. I mean, somebody could be paying the rent and you have to get along with them or you're going to be homeless. So that's a reason. And I'm not saying you should risk that. But nonetheless, I had a topic tonight. And the topic was miracles and phenomena. And one of the things I have observed is that when you're involved with what we could call multidimensional consciousness, things happen in this realm that wouldn't happen or couldn't happen without that multidimensional connection. And the way I've come to understand it is this realm is built from other dimensions, except we can't see them. And mostly this realm is working by the laws of this dimension. But when you start bringing in dimensional frequencies from other realms, you add a whole new realm of possibilities to the mix. I remember in one conversation with the Elohim, they would say, well, you see it as a miracle, but to us it's not a miracle. That's just, we just think it and it happens. So when you start connecting with these guys, and connecting doesn't mean you have to channel. It could mean just that you come to these conference calls and you can feel the frequency of the calls. There's a frequency on these calls. These sources are actually energetic. I've learned this over time, and I'm pretty sure of this conclusion, that those sources are paying attention to these calls, and that their frequency is here in the spaces. If you keep coming into these calls, you start getting into those frequencies. And as you get into those frequencies, you start to have the potential to recreate things in the physical through the flowing in of frequencies from other dimensions. And, of course, when you even think of the possibility of this, if you want to engage positive group souls, you have to, A, do things for the highest good of all concerned. That has to be a very high intent. And, B, not violate free will. And beyond that, magic can happen here. And I've had a lot of magic. Carla's had magic. Terry's had magic. And everybody wants magic. So, you know, it's my hope that if we share a little bit of our magic, that the potentials for that might rub off on other people, and they'll take it home and find their own way of connecting with the frequencies that can transform their lives and even transform this planet. That was my topic. So, Carla, is that okay with you?
That's fine.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I am sure lots of things happened. And I don't know them all in your life. I remember reading this amazing story of Don Elkin flying a plane, I believe, and Uri Geller fixing his plane from the ground.
That's right. I was there. It happened.
Yeah. Why don't you share that story? Because in terms of miracles, that's a good... Was that before you started channeling Ra?
No, that was the year after I began.
The year after,
it was in 1975. And that year, we were asked to go to the Fort Smith conference of, I believe it was MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, or it could have been APRO, the Association for Paranormal Research. One of those two UFO groups was having an annual meeting. It was a big 300, 400 person meeting. And Don and I had been asked to be consultants on a movie called The Force Beyond, which after Don saw the last cut of it, he changed the title to The Farce Beyond. But I digress. We went to Fort Smith in a Baron. It's a high-end plane. It's sort of like taking a Cadillac. Don rented one because we had Morris Hoagland and we had Elizabeth Hoagland with us, as well as me and Don, and we needed the four seats. So we had a double-engine plane.
Did you say Hoagland?
Hoagland, yeah.
Richard, connected to Richard Hoagland?
It's no relation.
Okay, just checking.
All right. The Kentucky Hoaglands. anyway, they were with us, and we had done the shooting that we intended to do at Fort Smith, and we were on our way home, and it was icing badly. The windshield was completely covered. We were in zero visibility conditions, could not see out of the airplane. And then the horizon failed. Well, when the horizon fails, you don't know whether you're straight in the air or whether you're tilting to one side or the other until you fall off of one wing. You fall off of one wing, and then Don was able to recover and get straight again until the next time we fell off of one side because we couldn't see out, you see. And it was a terrifying thing. It was completely dark. It was very cold. It was raining. It was thundering. And Don was doing his very best to keep us in the air. What he was concerned about was, you know, running into something, a tower or even a very high hill, because we weren't that far from Evansville, Indiana. And there's a lot of, it's a university town, there's a lot of radio tower activity there. So it was a tense moment. And all of a sudden, the horizon started working perfectly. Now, of course, a horizon never starts up again. A horizon is like a toy top. You know, you spin it, it spins, and if it goes down, it doesn't pick itself up and start spinning again. That's the way a gyroscopic horizon works. So it was a miracle that it started working again, and Don didn't trust it, so he put us down in Evansville, and we stayed the night and came home the next day. However, the horizon continued working perfectly, and they could find nothing wrong with it. But it had been out for a solid half hour before it came back on. Well, about a month later, Don was deadheading to Los Angeles to pick up a flight. He was an airline pilot. That was his day job. And he worked for Eastern Airlines. He was a captain of a 747. Very good pilot. And he had to get to work, so he was deadheading to pick up an airplane and start his working day the next day in Los Angeles. He was coming from Atlanta. And he found out that Uri was going out there, too, so he made arrangements to deadhead out on that flight. It was a little early, so he had some time. He wanted to talk to Uri. They were good friends at the time. Mm-hmm. And Don was talking to him, he told him this story, and Uri said, wait a minute, and Don was sitting on one of two hotel beds, you know, in the hotel room where Uri was staying. Uri says, it's a manila folder, look, it's on that bed right by you, pick it up. Don picks up a manila folder, he opens it up, and there is Uri's writing, horizon went out, ? And he had felt the energy move through him. at precisely the time. He dated it and timed it. It was a precise of the day and precise of the time when we were in extremis in the air, falling over our wings and Don, you know, just getting us back up by his great skill as a pilot. And or he said, I think I fixed your horizon. And I think he did too. So we're mighty grateful.
If you don't know who Uri Geller is, in the 60s, I believe, the 60s or 70s, he was a guy.
Uri
first
came
guy.
Out in 74.
Mm-hmm. 74. He was the first guy that was bending spoons publicly, bending spoons and forks on TV. It was all the major shows. And he would even tell people to take their broken wristwatches or broken alarm clocks and put it on the television, and he would fix them. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. And he
Remember
did
that.
Do
yeah.
that. The
yeah.
only time that he had difficulty doing those things was when he was in the presence of scientists who were very skeptical, of course. But even under those situations, he was able to manifest enough demonstrative ability that he worried the government greatly. He really did. He was doing something at Stanford University, and there were classified research projects in the same building, a couple of floors over him and a couple of floors below him, and he had no idea. But the energy that he was putting out when they were doing the tests on him were messing with the government tests, and of course it was inadvertent on his part, but it got the government very, very suspicious, and the poor guy was shadowed for years. I doubt that they're doing it anymore, but they certainly were then. They shadowed everybody connected with Uri and with Andrea Puharic, which Don was also a very good friend of Andrea's. So it was kind of hairy for us there for a couple of years, because we were bugged so much that our telephones were bugged so much that it was difficult getting a call out. And I just pick up the phone and I say, okay, guys, I'm calling my mom and I'd like to apologize ahead of time. It's really going to be boring, but I need to call my mom. So would you please give me a line? And then I'd get a line. And, you know, it was that obvious. So the thing that really baffled them the most was that one day I had a friend come over while we were being so incredibly bugged, and I was telling this guy the story. Well, I did not know this, but he had just taken an elephant dose of LSD, which he was prone to do in those days. These were the days before he became a psychologist so that he could help the people that he used to be. But at any rate, Ralph found out that the CIA was on the line, and so he picks up the phone and he starts rattling off numbers and words at random. And you could not do this if you were in your normal state of mind. But he was very much free from all moorings, and his brain was sagging greatly in the middle. And so he just, for minutes, probably 5 minutes, he rattled off, you know, five, telephone, computer, blanket, six, seven, bowl, smaller bowl, book. You know, I'm doing it because I'm looking around at things and naming them, but he wasn't looking at anything. He was just off. And we had a whole lot of activity around the house after that. I'm sure that they're still trying to figure out that code.
on the story with Uri Geller, there was a little question mark on the story, and the question was Uri obviously had awareness of this plane that Don was flying, but he didn't know it was Don, did he?
He didn't know it was Don, and he wasn't even absolutely sure it was an airplane. He could just feel the energy going through him, and it felt like he was fixing a horizon. He just got the impression that the energy was fixing a horizon, so that's what he wrote down on this manila folder.
I see. Yeah.
He was not entirely in control of his gifts, and they sometimes scared him.
Especially when
he would heal. And he didn't like to do that. He didn't like anybody to talk about it, but he could heal you. Gene Roddenberry was riding with him on the airplane one time, and Uri found that he had burned his hand badly, and so Uri just put his hand over Gene's hand and held it there for a minute, and all of the pain was gone, and you could almost not even see a scar. You couldn't see the blisters or anything. Mm-hmm. It was fading from red to pink to nothing. And Uri said, please don't talk about this to anybody, because, you know, Gene Roddenberry was in a very nosy business, you know, he was in show business TV, and you know, if he started talking about Uri healing his hand, it would have been even worse for Uri than it was.
Mm-hmm.
But when these things happen to you, when you get a gift like that, you're not in control of the gift. It's a gift, but at the same time, it's sort of running through your system. And that's something I wanted to say about miracles and phenomena. The reason that we can be magic, the reason that you can be magic, the reason that everyone can be magic, is that we are this unique being that is completely in space-time, completely in the world of matter and weight and mass and physics as we know it. And we have this energy body that lives within us while we are incarnate. And that is the vehicle in which our soul stream moved into this physical vehicle. And it's hooked there by something called a silver cord in spiritualist terms. And the silver cord hooks this energy body right along the spine. And this energy body with all the chakras, you've heard about the chakras, they are our presence in space-time. But that's the time-space part of us. That is the magical part of us. That is the energetic part of us. And the energy is much more real than the mass, the weight, the physics, and all that. So when we are free enough of our self-definitions as a limited being to use our energy and to use it with great intensity and pure intention, wonderful things happen. And you've heard all kinds of stories about how a mom finds out her son is under a car, so she picks up the front bumper. And mom could never in her million years pick up the front bumper, but because it's her baby under there, she gets it up and gets him out. And you hear stories like this all the time.
You know the story of my sister, right?
Yeah. Why don't you tell that one?
I'll tell it really fast. I've told it so much, and there's newer stories, but that was the first story that happened to me that got my attention with the Elohim, where I had asked about my sister in 2002, and my sister had lupus, and I asked them, can you tell me something I can share with my sister about her lupus that would help her? And they said, in 3 months, she was going to face a decision where she was going to choose whether to live or to die. And I said, oh, my God, that's not the answer I wanted to hear. Well, almost three months to the day, I get a call from my brother-in-law, and he tells me my sister is going into the hospital, and she had this serious cancer, and they weren't sure she was going to survive. And I then go do a channeling, and I said, excuse me, can you guys help? And they said they could. So the next thing I get is a phone call from my brother-in-law that my sister is alive and that she survived the operation. And at this time, I was about 4 months into these communications, and I didn't believe they were real. Daphne is knocking me and saying, those guys want to talk to you again. And they just don't say, ask us questions, and they tell me they're the Elohim and they created the physical universe. There's no way I believe that. But they didn't ask anything of me other than to ask questions, so I just asked questions. So now, a few weeks after my sister's cancer went away, I get another phone call from my brother-in-law where he says her lupus disappeared. She had to go in for tests to see if cancer had come back, and the nurse said there's no cancer, but there's no lupus. And they kept testing her, and there was no lupus. And the nurse said, this can't happen because lupus never disappears from a test. So now I go back and I'm channeling, and I said, how did you guys do that? And they said, it was like putting a filter in her blood and taking the lupus out. Now that locked me for a loop. Imagine there's an intelligence in another dimension that's maybe at the beginning of all dimensions, if you believe what they say, and they can project energy through all the sacred geometries, everything, and move right into my sister's blood and take a pathogen out. Now, that was incredible. And my sister's still alive. She didn't really get healthy. She still had a lot of things wrong with her. But her lupus disappeared, and her life has served a purpose since that time. Now, Terry, as usual, you're sitting in the back sending us your angelic vibrations.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, it's like when people are, like in the situation you mentioned earlier, when people are talking, and you just don't judge anything they're saying, but you just put love light in, like it can dissolve some of the bitter chitter chatter. It's and it takes not judgment, just loving and getting them where they're at. Anyway, those were my thoughts. But there
you
are stories about Go ahead.
Who said there's stories about?
I did. The stories about Uri Geller are fascinating. I love stories like that and how he fixed the horizon. The other way around.
We might continue this topic for our next talk, Carla, because I think that, when you talk about these phenomena, it kind of gives people a kind of hope, because I think so many people are jaded. They don't believe this can happen. And when I was younger, I wouldn't have believed it could happen. And there's so many learning how, because you can, there's something you can learn about this. There's a way kind of to project intention. And you have to do, one of the things about learning how is you have to be very careful. I don't know if we should talk about that or not, because then that could cause people to start trying to use the power of intention in a negative way or self-serving way. But the way dimensions integrate and the way they blend so that we can access the part of our energy body, the creational part, that gives us the opportunity to change circumstances in the physical at hyperspeed. And that's the potential. And it's a matter of slipping out of the consensus energy that everyone is clamped down under. Now, Carla, are you there?
Yeah.
Why don't we, we have at 7:50, we probably can be on for another minute. Why don't we take a moment and hold the space for everyone that's listening, where if you're listening and you're feeling an uplifted energy, and we're quiet for a little bit, why don't you put your request, remembering the highest good of all concerned and not violating free will, insert your request into the higher dimensions for something that you would like to transform in your life, or for someone you care about, or even for the planet. Is that okay with you, Carla?
That sounds like a lovely idea.
And Terry, is that okay? Right now, we're just going to ask each of us to expand to the greatest and highest of our potential, to feel the energies of the connection with the higher realms. And when you feel that space, I want you to think with your highest thought, with your strongest intention, of a transformation you'd like. Remembering the highest good of all concerned and free will. And do it right now. We'll leave about 30 seconds for you to plant that seed. All right, 7:52. Seth is going to be glad that I'm cutting off and he doesn't have to come in and interrupt me. Thank you, everybody that's on the conference call. Just see here.
All callers are muted. All callers are unmuted.
Are you guys still on the conference call?
Yeah.
Yep, we're here. Why don't we all say goodbye to BBS listeners together? 1, 2, 3.
Night.
Bye.
Bye.
Night.
Thank you, Wynn, Terry. Thank you, Carla. Aloha.
I'll see you guys.
Aren't we corny?
Thank you, my friend.
Aren't we corny?